fact, I'm going to talk about the Genesis problem, and it's a kind of a loose and speculative, somewhat speculative talk, but I'm going to try to be provocative, but in so doing, I hope I don't turn Genesis into Exodus, but it's obvious if that happens. So Mike mentioned yesterday the notion of a hypocritic embryo, and I think it's a very interesting concept, and I want to try to explore that in greater depth. What do we mean by that, and why is it that hurricanes hatch from an egg, unlike other phenomena? And I'm going to try to convince you that many, and maybe all, actual tropical cyclones begin their lives or have to begin their lives as a cold core middle-level cyclone. Okay? Not necessarily of mesoscale, sometimes of synoptic scale, but I'm going to try to convince you on thermodynamic grounds why that almost has to be the case. I can think of a couple of ways out of it, but they're somewhat unlikely. So we were admonished at the very beginning of this workshop to try to be conscious of the fact that there are non-specialists here, and I'm going to try to do that. And I want to begin at the sort of the beginning of the story, which is whenever you talk about some class of instabilities or phenomena that develop in the atmosphere, it's helpful to think carefully about what you're considering the basic state to be. All right. So if you're talking about problems of baroclinic instability of the mid-latitude flow, you typically take some nice zonal mean jet and thermal wind balance, and that's your basic state. In the tropics, Isaac Held mentioned this as well in his talk, is a very nice kind of basic state concept he uses, the state of radiant convective equilibrium, whose fundamental property is it's one-dimensional, at least in a statistical mean sense it's one-dimensional. We consider the boundary conditions to be horizontally homogeneous. And here's a photograph I took out of the window of an airplane, which sort of it's close to my visualization of what this state might look like in nature. The important thing is, in this idealization, all of the energy transfer is in one dimension, it's in the vertical. So you have only radiated and convective heat transfer. You have this nice spectrum of moist convective clouds from shallow, non-precipitating cumulus here to very deep clouds that are strongly precipitating and can go all the way to the tropopause up here. And in the mean state, the upward transport of energy and water from the surface is balanced by radiative transfer. And so if you sort of look at a cartoon of this state, here's a kind of a vertical slice, you have deep clouds. We know, beginning from the work of Bjerknes, actually, in the 1930s, that the anisotropy of convection, the irreversibility that has to do with the fact that rain falls down and not up, ultimately, makes the convective state such that the actual deep cloud towers can only cover a very tiny fractional area, typically less than 1%. And so you have strong upward motion in these towers and fallout of precipitation, compensated by much weaker but much more extensive downward motion. So characteristically in radiative equilibrium, these updraft speeds are of order of a few meters per second, and the downdraft speeds are of the order of a centimeter per second or so. By the way, it was a long outstanding problem in idealized radiative convective equilibrium what actually controls the velocity scale of the updrafts. And it turns out that I'm going to give you the short answer, and it will be completely mysterious to me, but you can come and talk to me afterwards. If you want to know what external parameters govern the updraft speed, it's the surface tension of water and the acceleration of gravity. Okay? Come and talk to me. But that doesn't make sense. I hope it doesn't. All right, because it took us a long time to figure that out. But, so in this radiative convective equilibrium state, this is what the radiative transfer looks like. So this is energy transport or flux versus altitude. And there is a net downward solar flux here, okay, which in this idealization is constant. That's actually not true. There's some absorption by clouds and water vapor, but for the most part, it's constant, that part that's not reflected. And the upward transport to balance this is accomplished mostly by material motions, convective heat transfer. In this little thin layer below the bases of the clouds, it's dry convective turbulence. But starting at cloud base and up, it's moist convective turbulence. That flux decreases with altitude and goes to zero at the tropopause. there's a little bit of infrared flux out of the ocean of the tropics, and that conversely increases with altitude and reaches the value of the solar flux at the tropopause. So in the stratosphere, you have radiative equilibrium, where the solar and radiative fluxes are equal and opposite sign. In the troposphere, the radiative flux, the long-wave radiative flux, is divergent, meaning it's cooling. It's cooling the troposphere at a rate of about a degree or a degree and a half per day. And that's balanced by the convergence of the upward convective flux. By the way, if you actually do detailed calculations, it's remarkable how linear these profiles are. I don't know if that's an accident or not. But. Now, another interesting and very important character of this state of radiative convective equilibrium, which is also something you see in the real tropical atmosphere, is that a measure of the energy content, or actually the entropy of the air, if you look at a profile, it tends to look like this. So this is, you know, pressure, which we use as a surrogate for altitude, the tropopause being up around 200 or so of these units. If you look at this quantity, it's well mixed in this thin layer below the base of the clouds. It decreases with height, reaches sort of a broad minimum somewhere in the middle to lower troposphere, and then it increases with height. It actually increases even more rapidly up here, but for graphical purposes, stopped it there. All right. And so the energy content in the middle troposphere is typically low. There's a minimum there. That's very important for what I'm going to be talking about. Now, the other interesting property of this radiative convective equilibrium state is that it is it forces the atmosphere to be quite far out of thermodynamic equilibrium with the underlying ocean, which you can include in that calculation. So if I took an air parcel and brought it into thermodynamic equilibrium with the ocean at its temperature, it would have a value of this moistatic energy up around here somewhere. Right? In fact, it's this difference that makes hurricanes possible. Without that, you can't sustain a flux-driven vortex like a hurricane. So, given that background state, I want to first review what I call the conventional wisdom. Now, here I'm going to take a real stab at the conventional wisdom, as you can tell from the fact that I've even employed that phrase. And I'm going to pick out a phrase from an undergraduate textbook, which is fairly characteristic. I don't mean to pick on poor Rick Anthes here. This is, first of all, old book, and secondly, he's by no means singular in this event. It's the way undergraduates are typically thought to think about the Genesis problem. Okay, so I'll read it. Numerous cumulonimbus clouds, these are the convective elements, gradually moisten their environment. This warming, okay, he first uses moisten here, and then suddenly this warming appears here as though there's an obvious connection between the two. Produces a pressure fall at the surface because warm air weighs less than cool air, right? Sure. The slowly converging horizontal winds near the surface respond to this pressure drop by accelerating inward, and this produces lifting, so the thunderstorms become more numerous and intense, and the feedback loop is established. So the notion here, and it's a notion that permeates a lot of literature on this, is that the feedback that makes this whole thing work is a feedback between the flow of air and the convection. The convection heats the air, that causes inflow, the inflow supplies the moisture, and you're off and running, okay? Now, first thing to point out about this argument that's a little bit obvious is there's no reason this couldn't work over the land, right? But this is how hurricanes got started. At least you should see nascent hurricanes as commonly over land as over the water. But in fact, the logic behind this was very succinctly disproved before it even appeared by an Austrian physicist at the turn of the last century, von Hahn, who made a very almost childlike simple argument, but which I think is fundamentally correct. He noticed that since a thundercloud itself is not observed to give any pressure fall at the surface, in fact, it's the opposite that goes on. You typically get a pressure rise at the surface. It would be unreasonable to assume that magnifying this process, having a lot of these clouds, would produce the strongest pressure falls known to man. It was very simplistic reasoning, given the fact they didn't have a lot of observations, but they knew things back there. And one of the things they knew, because it had been established some decades before, is that convective clouds always produce high pressure at the surface. And the reason is because of this minimum in moistatic energy, which also reflects the fact that you're dry, typically, a few kilometers above the surface. So you get a convective updraft, it produces precipitation. Some of that precipitation invariably re-evaporates into this dry air and chills it. It then forms a downdraft, which is as important an element of most convective cells as updrafts, although they're not often talked about, they're at least as important. They bring this low static energy air into the boundary layer, cooling it, creating a mesoscale high pressure system of airflow flowing out. And von Hahn simply said, okay, now put all this together, what are you going to get? More high pressure, right? It doesn't explain in and of itself the hurricane, which has obviously low pressure at the surface. Naive reasoning, maybe, but there's something very fundamental about that, right? Hurricanes work by elevating the moist static energy in the boundary layer, but convective cells tend to do just the opposite, right? So, and this is, you know, this is just another illustration of this is a sort of a cartoon of the life cycle of a characteristic precipitating convective cloud that originated in the famous thunderstorm experiment of the post-war era, which shows that once you start getting precipitation, some of it evaporates into this dry air loft, brings this low entropy down to the surface. And it's been known for a long time, and there's no argument about that. So here's the problem we have. Here's our moist static energy profile. Here's the saturation value, SST. To get a tropical cyclone, we have to start moving the boundary layer in that direction. And so I'm going to now work with a hypothesis, and that is that, again, which was sort of loosely stated at the beginning of the seminar, that all tropical cyclones have to begin in a cold core, nearly saturated mesoscale, or perhaps synoptic scale cyclone, with cyclonic rotation above the surface, but if anything, anticyclonic rotation at the surface. That's the starting point. Now, why do I make that hypothesis? Well, the reasoning is pretty simple. And I'm going to exaggerate here, but the first thing you have to do is shut off the downdrafts. Now, it's an exaggeration to say you have to completely shut them off, of course. You have to make them sufficiently weak, all right? No downdrafts. How are you going to do that? Okay, how are you actually going to do that? How are you going to turn off the downdrafts? Well, the most straightforward way to do that is by bringing the air to saturation on some scale larger than that of the convective cloud. If you take a convective cloud and it goes up into pre-saturated air, there's no way it can create a downdraft, at least not by the evaporation of water. Right? So by raising the entropy, or by saturating the air at mid-levels, you can do this. All right. So saturation plus, and this is something, by the way, I forgot to state about radiative convective equilibrium that's also central to my argument, is that because convection is fast, and it's much faster than radiation, it typically brings the tropical atmosphere into a state which is just about neutral or critical, if you will, to moist convection. We observe that. The lacerated temperature falls nicely along the moist adiabat. We argue amongst ourselves how perfectly that's true, but to first order, it's very definitely the case. So if you have saturation and you have convective neutrality, it also means that you have more or less uniform moist static energy with height. But how are you going to bring that about? The problem is moist static energy is an individually conserved process. The only way you can change moist static energy following a parcel is through surface fluxes or radiative transfer and so on. Phase change doesn't do it. So moist static energy is conserved. You have to make it kind of uniform. And so, and this part will become clear when I show you the next diagram, necessarily, at this stage, you actually have to reduce the moist static energy near the surface. The air above the boundary layer will be correspondingly cold, and the only way you can maintain, for some non-trivial length of time, a cold anomaly in the tropics is to have it rotationally balanced. So this is, I mean, it's a really simple bit of reasoning here. But here's what you're starting with. To shut off the downdrafts, you sort of have to eliminate this vertical gradient or vastly reduce it anyway. Now, you could pump a lot of energy into the atmosphere, right, through surface fluxes or maybe through some kind of radiation process. Maybe if you had an anvil cloud in the upper troposphere blocking long-wave radiation for a long time, you could actually elevate it diabatically. But failing that, any process that's conservative has to kind of conserve this Kalmin moist static energy. And so if you make this uniform and conserve its mean value, you're starting with this profile, you're going to wind up with a profile that looks like this. Okay, so the moist static energy at the surface will necessarily go down because you started with a local maximum there. You're mixing in the vertical, it has to drop. On the other hand, the adiabat that begins in the boundary layer here, all right, also determines the temperature of the free tropics here. And so that also implies, if you're still near convective neutrality, that you've got a cold troposphere. Right? So in other words, if you want to create this uniform moist-static energy while conserving the column moist-static energy, necessarily that column will end up cold. But dynamically in the tropics, all right, you can't sustain a temperature anomaly locally. It just will radiate away as gravity waves. All right? So something has to happen. And the only way you can sustain that is if that cold column is in some sort of rotational balance. And so you put that all together, and the state that's associated with this is one in which you have a cyclonic rotation increasing with height, which is what the thermal wind equation tells you must be true if you have a local cold anomaly, right? So the logic is really simple at the end of the day. It consists of a few parts, but unless you pump a lot of energy into a column, okay, unless you have some way of doing that, and of course a fully developed hurricane is good at doing that because it's got such strong surface winds, but we're talking about genesis here, you're going to have to turn off the downdrafts because they're so effective in suppressing the moist static energy of the boundary layer that even if you have a little bit of enhanced surface fluxes, it's not going to counter these downdrafts.
I guess. I take an intermediate position in the sense that you don't necessarily have to turn off the downdrafts, but you have to confine them and kind of inhibit their energetic potency.
Well, right.
I mean, you're not shutting them off. In our simulations, we don't see shut downdrafts shut off. They're still there. You're limiting them rotationally to the development process. So you're absolutely right.
In a statistical sense, to be a little bit more precise than to say shutting it off, you've got to achieve a state where in some kind of reasonable ensemble average in the core of the system, the downdraft flux of low static energy in the boundary layer is not sufficient to compensate for the surface fluxes, which may also be locally enhanced. That's the state you have to get to. So I'm obviously oversimplifying when I say you have to turn them off. If you achieve a state of nearly uniform moist-static energy, it will be necessarily cold, and to maintain that state, you have to be in rotational balance. That implies a cyclone aloft, maybe a weak anticyclone on the surface. So that's the notion, all right? And so I'm going to spend the rest of the talk trying to support that by a number of means. One is through numerical
simulation. Tell me about these storms sort of going up and down. You showed that picture where, of course, the towers occupy a very small fraction of area.
Right.
But when you start to get these convective clusters, that's probably not true again.
That's right. They certainly start occupying a progressively larger fractional area, never very large. But the fact is that convection can only transport moist static energy. You can't change column enthalpy.
Right.
And that mere fact says if you want to get to the stage, whatever the fractional coverage, that you vastly decrease the downdraft theta efflux in the boundary layer, you're going to have to homogenize the moist static energy. Convection, no doubt, is what does that.
Mm-hmm.
But the end state of that is a cold atmosphere. That's the main point. So what we're going to do is to look at this first in the context of an axisymmetric but non-hydrostatic so-called cloud resolving model. This is not an accurate description because we have radial grid spacing of 7.5 kilometers. It doesn't begin to resolve clouds. So I'm using that by convention, but it isn't true. The fact is we're not parameterizing clouds. That's what we really mean by that. All right. And actually, sorry, 3.75 kilometers, not quite as bad as I would expect, 300 meters in the vertical. And we're going to initialize this model in a somewhat different way. We're going to take an atmosphere, first of all, in which there's no thermodynamic disequilibrium between the atmosphere and the ocean. That is, it won't sustain a hurricane at all. But we're going to insert into this basic state a fairly large scale, actually something like a sub-synoptic scale, cold core cyclone. No wind at the surface, thermal wind balance in gradient sense. All right? And we're and I will note about that state that the center of this cold core cyclone is not far away from being saturated with water. It's humid. And because it's cold, it is locally not in thermodynamic equilibrium with the ocean, right? Because it's locally cold. That's all. And watch what happens. Well, I guess before I show you what happens, I should say what we usually do with experiments like this, going back at least to the 1980s and probably before that, is we typically take the same model, initialize it with a warm core vortex, and what we find is that if you start with a strong enough one, this is the amplitude of the maximum wind versus time, it amplifies into something like a hurricane. If you start with weak perturbation, it might do that, but it takes a very, very long time to happen. And even in simple models, this is a laptop, you know, order a laptop hurricane model, which I like to use. It has the same qualitative behavior. You start with a warm core vortex. It actually weakens and becomes a cold core vortex. And you can't see that by looking at this diagram, but then it all amplifies. If you start with a weak perturbation, it just sort of dies out.
This Bohr is Mann's model is your own Roshonov's model?
No, it's Bohr than that. It's the CHIPS model. It's a quasi-balance. You don't know about that yet. Anyway, anybody who wants to run that, come and see me. It's very fast. But if you take that Bohr Mann's model and you do nothing but saturate the innermost 100 kilometers of the initial state, which, by the way, means dumping a lot of energy into it, so it's not realistic at all, okay? But you're just going to saturate the atmosphere above the boundary layer all the way to the trope loss. That is linearly unstable. We put the smallest perturbation into that, boom, it just goes. That's the red curve here. So hurricanes like the state of being saturated. So now we'll go to the experiment I just described, the genesis under the cold core cyclone aloft. This is what I said, the ambient conditions don't support tropical cyclones without that cold core low. The cold core low does actually also make it thermodynamic disequilibrium possible in this particular case. And this is what it does, okay? We start from a very weak perturbation. This is the maximum wind versus time, the blue curve here. This is the maximum wind at the surface, okay? And which is a little bit less in this case. This is the so-called potential intensity. It fairly rapidly increases, but then it starts a decline, and the decline is entirely expected because you're talking about a very limited volume of fluid that's out of thermodynamic equilibrium with the sea. Eventually it warms up by the strong surface fluxes and it's coming into equilibrium. And let's look at what happens by looking at the field. So this is the azimuthal velocity as a function of radius. And this is altitude. I don't know why I forgot not to put day zero, but this is not too long after day zero. This is what we start with, a fairly large scale, synoptic scale cyclone near the tropopause in this case. No wind at the surface. All right, here's the perturbation temperature, which is in equilibrium with that by gradient balance. And this is the entropy, essentially the equivalent potential temperature cap, so that we don't see the strong gradients in the stratosphere in the initial condition. And let's just look at a quasi movie of the evolution. There's your cold core cyclone. Of course, it's warm core in the upper troposphere as it's decaying in the stratosphere, I should say. And very quickly, inside of this cold core, like Russian dolls, you get the formation of a much smaller scale warm core cyclone. This is the nascent tropical cyclone. So its strongest winds are now down low. So it's warm core on the mesoscale, but it's still cold core on the synoptic scale. So it's locally warm within cold. Okay. And that just amplifies. The color scale is changing. I didn't control for that. Sorry about that. But and then, of course, an anticyclone begins to develop. The little warm core cyclone that develops inside this synoptic scale cold core gradually erodes that cold core. And So now you have this development of this, an anti-site, you begin to have the development of an anti-site. Now here are the traces or the vestiges of that initial bulk core and so on. Okay.
You show the whole computational radius there? I mean,
No, just a tiny fraction of the domain. So I'll just play through that once again so you can see it happening. Okay, so the bottom line is, and we've done many, many experiments like that, if you begin with a synoptic scale or even a mesoscale saturated cold core line, it's very easy for a tropical cyclone to develop inside of that numerically. It just goes. You don't even need a finite amplitude perturbation. And there is some evidence that that this happens in nature, and I'm going to show you my interpretation of some field data that we collected in 1991 in the tropical experiment in Mexico. So if any of you want to know where my email address came from, it came from this experiment. And we went to the west coast of Mexico, where you have very near which you have the highest number density of tropical cyclones in the world, the eastern North Pacific. So this is the a chart based on climatology showing the number of storms that pass within 75 nautical miles of each of these points in the summer months. And these storms are invariably moving from east to west, so the gradient of this in a loose sense is where you have the most occurrences of gensis in this region here, densification of cyclones. There's an airport in Acapulco, so we took two instrumented aircraft there and flew into a number of systems. The experiment was a partial success. It was a failure in the sense that we would have liked to have surveyed cloud clusters that did not develop into tropical cyclones, and we tried mightily, but we had the Midas touch. Everything we flew into became a hurricane. Just our bad luck. We would have liked half and half. So we do the best we can. And I'm going to show you first a sequence of infrared satellite pictures. This is the southern coast of Mexico here. We're at 0800 on the 2nd of August, if you can remember that. And I want you to watch this. This is an area of very cold cloud tops. It's a black and white scale here. This black here represents pretty much the ocean. There are no clouds at all. Then you go up to the scale. There you have very cold cloud tops. So there we are, 0800 on the 2nd of August. This is one day later. And the feature that you saw before is now out here with considerably warmer, therefore lower cloud tops in this region here. This is transient convection that you often see off the coast of Mexico in the early morning hours because of the land breeze that forms. Never mind that. This is the system that we're interested in. Here we are, not quite a day, but more like 12 hours later. And here is the system in question. It's not very well organized in the satellite imagery. And here we are, let's see, this is 2003. This is about 8 hours later, okay? And here is the system, a little bit more circular, but still not very well organized in the satellite imagery. And then something interesting happens at this time, and this has been noted by a lot of researchers, is that you have this sort of gestation period where this cloud cluster doesn't do much. And then all of a sudden, it's like somebody set off a bomb in the center of it. You get these big hot towers, as Mike, for example, calls them, that suddenly develop in this inner core. And you're sort of off and running at this point through a full tropical cyclone. This proceeds to develop over the next day into a hurricane. So there are practicalities of running field experiments via two aircraft that can only fly 8 hours at a time, and you have to have crew rest and so on and so on. So the best we could manage was 8 hours with each aircraft with 5-hour gaps. And in practice, some of those 8 hours are used to actually get to the storm and back, so we don't have continuous coverage in time. The aircraft, one of the two aircraft at the time, was equipped with a Doppler radar tail-mounted, sends out pulses of radiation, backscatter off of rain and so on. We measure the Doppler shift, you get the radial, or the component of velocity toward or away from the radar, and in fact, although this shows the scanning in a circular disk, in point of fact, the disk is a cone that points forward, and then there's a switch, and alternating rotations will look back. So if you look at the intersection of the radar paths with a horizontal plane, the the aircraft is flying along, so the aircraft is flying here. These are the backward pointing cones, and here are the forward pointing cones. So each point is surveyed twice by the radar beam. Once as the aircraft is approaching, looking forward, and then a little while later as the aircraft is receding, looking back. So you get two horizontal velocity components. Mass continuity gives you the third. Remarkably, just flying past with the aircraft, you get the three-dimensional velocity field. And so here are some examples of that. And you get them at all altitudes that there are reflectors at. And so here we are on the 2nd of August, 1991. This is at an altitude of 2 kilometers, and this is the wind field as constructed with the Doppler radar. These are sort of conventional meteorological notation. So the flags point perversely into the wind, and each of these long barbs is 10 nautical miles per hour, or about 5 meters per second. And so what you see here is a mesoscale cyclone, all right, centered at about this point here. All right. On the scale, this is a longitude, this latitude is about 100 kilometers apart. It's a 100 kilometer scale. Cyclone 2 kilometers, 7 kilometers, pretty much the same thing, shifted a little bit to the east. Okay. And this is what the aircraft itself measured for winds. This is sort of redundant with the first diagram. So all the, in this particular map, the cyclone's down here. And I tried to contour the temperature, but for all practical purposes, the temperature is completely constant at this time. But the boundary layer and the Doppler, the radar really can't see the boundary layer because of ground clutter and so on. But we actually flew the plane down at Saturn 975, about 300 meters above the surface, in, well inside the boundary layer. And here are the winds measured there. They're pretty much, if anything, anticyclonic. And the blue curves are the temperature. So you have a broad temperature minimum. And this is very typical of what you see underneath cloud clusters, whether they're over land or over the ocean. It's cold air, divergent, if anything, weakly anticyclonic. No indications of any sort of strong cyclone. Now, this is 2 days later, which is the next time we have the Doppler platform out there.
Yes. Can you show that picture again?
Sure.
I don't see anticyclonic winds except maybe for the on a broad scale.
It's, well, down here it's
maybe
a bit cyclonic.
Yeah,
but
maybe
underneath that mesoscale cyclone aloft, we actually did calculate the vorticity at one point. I wish I had it.
You can kind of see it up.
There's a little bit. But it's actually the stronger quantity. There's the divergence, not the vorticity.
Well, I understand. You've got to be careful because, you know, I mean, if you're just taking rings of particles and bringing them down to the surface, if you start with F, you're never going to change the sign.
I'm talking about relative.
Okay.
No, absolutely. It never goes negative, absolutely. Let's see. Now, this is 700 millibars 2 days later. The whole system has moved to the west. You have about the same magnitude circulation aloft, again, sort of a mesoscale cyclone, a little bit stronger, perhaps, up in this region. And down in the boundary layer, things have changed quite dramatically from the previous day. Right? Now you do have a strong but very small-scale cyclone, and I've contoured the wet bulb temperature and some units of tenths of a degree, and it's still cold in the center. Except that, and this is a sampling problem, but the aircraft definitely went through a local maximum, you know, relative to the surrounding at this point, so you actually have a hint, at least, of relative warmth inside an otherwise mesoscale pool of low to baby air, but rotating cyclonically.
Those contours are dew point temperature or wet bulb temperature?
Wet bulb. Intense.
And the data is coming from where in between the budget?
The aircraft. So it's very poorly sampled.
So that, is that a subjective analysis?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. You could tell by the blue point. And so a day later, if you go back at 700 millibars, you have, you know, basically a tropical storm at this point. We're off and running, and it became Hurricane Guillermo. So during that middle flight, we actually solved the system, we think, in this transition stage. And we did a little experiment here, which was an attempt to mimic numerically what we thought we saw happening in the field. And we just took a standard tropical atmosphere, no motion at all, and we inserted into it a shower head, literally. Right? So we supplied a source of water, trying to mimic the effect of the sort of gentle rain that typically falls out of these stratiform anvils in these cloud clusters. And that rain evaporates in the dry air and drives a downdraft. There's inflow into that downdraft, which by conservation of angular momentum spins up the cyclone. And then you have outflow at the surface. And if you watch what happens, this is the maximum wind that in that domain as a function of time and hours.
The
shower head.
You say that it springs up the water. You had a weak disturbance.
No, there was nothing. Zero.
So it's spinning up F.
Spinning up F, that's all.
It's just spinning up slightly drizzled.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a light rain, basically. Sustained for 36 hours. And naturally, what you see here in this black curve is the spin-up of that mid-level cyclone. This black dashed curve, by contrast, is the maximum wind at the lowest model level, more or less at the surface. Okay. And it's zero for a while, for about 12 hours, and then it begins to spin up. And it becomes the maximum wind, if you will, when the system is decidedly warm core, around about here at 40 hours. So there's an initial spin-up. Then you turn off the shower head, it just spins down again, but then there's this intensification into a full sort of hurricane-like system. Now, I mean, I don't have a lot of time, but let me sort of summarize what we think was going on here. And this guess, based on impartial data and contrived numerical experiments, but you have at the very beginning of this process some process, as yet unspecified, that creates a cluster of these showers. Right? But these clusters are not uncommon, and they occur over land as readily as they occur over ocean. And the rain evaporates in these clusters, it produces downdrafts and so on. And you get this sort of this gestation stage where you don't actually have a lot of deep convection. You have some stratiform precipitation. You're always evaporating. You're spinning up a mid-level cyclone, that's the inflow into this downdraft. You've got an anticyclone down here. But what's happening, and this is the critical thing, is a lot of things. The spinning up is very important because it confines this cold anomaly. Otherwise, the cold anomaly would radiate away in internal waves. And the air is also drawing closer to saturation by the wet wall process. It's not only cooling, so you're lowering the saturation vapor pressure, it's actually acquiring water vapor from the evaporation. Rain goes getting moister. So you're bringing these two curves together. So what you're left with at this point is a cold, cyclonically rotating aloft, not necessarily at the surface, and nearly saturated, and it's way out of thermodynamic equilibrium with the ocean. It was already out of thermodynamic equilibrium, now it's really out of thermodynamic equilibrium. And here is, at this stage, something happens that cannot happen over land, and that is the ocean, this enormous heat reservoir, begins to rewarm the boundary layer and moisten it to the point where it's once again unstable and the convection fires up again. This is what we thought we saw in this sort of explosive growth of convection. But this convection is very odd convection. It's convection you never see outside of the circumstance, I'd argue, is that it's going up into air which is pretty much saturated, so it can't produce downdraft. And so it is actually a much simpler kind of convection. This is the hot tower convection. You get inflow at the surface. It just goes in, up, and out. There's no secondary cell of a downdraft because it's thermodynamically not possible. And so, of course, it begins to spin up at this stage right at the surface. And you're sort of off and running at this point. You've sort of switched on this whole engine where you're starting to extract heat from the ocean. There's a feedback between the wind and the extraction and so on. And you go on to a full hurricane. So that's the notion. And I want to end up, I'm sort of out of time, but I don't have enough time to do this, to show you that this is also going on rather spontaneously in a kind of different numerical simulation that I've been working with Dave Nolan and Eric Rappin down at the University of Miami. And we're running a radiative convective equilibrium simulation for the so-called lab-resolving model. It's really 2 kilometer resolution or grid spacing. It's the Wharf model, for those of you who want to know. Fixed ocean temperature on an F-plane. We do have a long-wave radiative cooling scheme. And we integrate this into statistical states of radiative convective equilibrium. And it's similar to what Isaac was talking about yesterday, except that we're doing it at much finer resolution without a convective parameterization. Otherwise, it's similar in concept to what Isaac was talking about. And most of the time, what we see when we look at the fields, this particular one is I'm going to show you, is from an early integration where there was actually a bug in the Wharf code that prevented us from doing doubly periodic domains. So this is actually a channel. We've actually been doing doubly periodic since then. We haven't been able to grind out the graphics in time for this meeting. So this is about 1,200 kilometers by 800 or something like that in horizontal. And this is the vertical velocity field, 1.3 kilometers above the surface. It's a snapshot in time, and you just see this sort of random, and this isn't technically random, but chaotic convection going on. That's usually what you see. This is at a particular value of the Coriolis parameter and an ocean temperature of 30 degrees. But if you either raise the sea surface temperature high enough or raise the Coriolis parameter high enough, you get a spontaneous transition, okay, to a cyclone-dominated regime similar to what Isaac was talking about. And you can clearly see that the domain isn't big enough because you'd like to have lots of cyclones here. But for the transition problem, it's probably okay. You're not really concerned about what happens in this fully developed state, which I'm not for this purpose. And these are extremely busy, and I don't have time either, but I'm going to try to show you a time sequence of various quantities in this domain. And you'll have to have good eyes, but not that good, to see what I'm talking about. The first quantity I'm going to show you is an entropy-like quantity, the moistoic energy, at the lowest model level, the boundary layer. And I'm just going to show you a sequence, and these are each of these panels is 2 hours apart. This time unit is essentially increments of 2 hours. And so the first thing that happens in the sequence of events that leads to the formation of the first cyclone in this domain during this integration actually winds up at the end of this first chunk of a day, creating this rather large cold pool. This is the signature of one of these mesoscale convective systems. You have cold air at the surface. And this is going on in time. Don't be fooled by the fact that the time seems to be reset. That's just we have concrete some of the graphical thing. This is continuing the sequence I showed you before. Here is the system that I want you to pay attention to. This is a cold air at the surface with very high entropy just outside of it, where you have very gusty winds at the leading edge of the advance of the cold air. And so it goes. And the system that develops into a hurricane, you can see sort of here emerging or close to the western end of this domain, which is doubly periodic, so this is a continuation of this. And this is continuing on in time. And finally, toward the end of the sequence, you actually get a high entropy core on a very small scale in the system. Right? But it starts out being in an anomalously low entropy. This is just surface pressure. And at the beginning of the sequence, you have this meso-high here. There it is. Here you can see it. You see some signatures of individual convective events in the model. We're continuing on in time. There's the meso-high. It's going along. Now look what's happened. At this time, suddenly, inside the high, as though somebody shot a rifle through the graph, there's a little tiny round, intense pressure minimum. This is the first cyclone that forms and becomes the hurricane. It forms inside a meso-high.
It's like a tornado.
It looks almost like a big tornado. And we're just continuing in time. And by the way, the color scales keep changing. I haven't quite mastered that. This is all very recent stuff. But you can quite clearly see that you've got a strong low-pressure system. Looks a bit like the charts Isaac was showing. This is the saturation moistoic energy at 3.8 kilometers, basically the temperature-like quantity. Early on, it's cold. Okay, this is the system that ultimately becomes a hurricane. It's cold. at, and this gets also into some of the points that Roger was talking about. This is constant altitude, not constant pressure. So be a little careful about that. It's cold core. There it is. It's still cold core even after that pressure developed at the surface, at least at this altitude. Here it is. It's passing through the west side of the domain and re-emerging on the east side. And it's only at the very end of this integration that you start to see a relative warm core inside the cold core. Well, even late in the game, it's still cold core, apparently at 3.8 kilometers, which is quite remarkable. I'm not going to show you. It's warm core in the high troposphere very early on. So
I can't help but ask. Yeah. Some people might say these are all details, but I think it's crucial. Where does vorticity of the surface come from?
In this integration, the ultimate source of vorticity is F, but it first gets spun up aloft. There is some transfer to relatively low levels, but you might see this in this particular diagram. I'm running out of time, so I'll have to be a little quick. Is that right? Am I running out of time?
Yeah,
pretty much
out of time.
Okay, I'll show this and then I'll skip the others and wrap up. This is a vertical section now, not a horizontal section, east-west through, at least we attempted to be through the core of the system, showing the north-south wind component. So what I want you to pay attention to starting now is here you have a cyclone aloft, southerlies located to the east of northerlies. It's up here, okay, and it's on a 100-kilometer scale. That's the mesocyclone aloft. Now watch what happens. Every once in a while, it tries to shoot down these fingers of high vorticity toward the surface, but never getting to the surface. But on a much smaller scale. You see that? This is probably just an example of us missing with the cross section going through the center.
I lived in Oklahoma, about a dynamic pipe.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this is an interesting time because, in fact, for example, here, the sense of rotation of the surface is actually the opposite of the sense of rotation aloft. But this is the first time that you actually get the high vorticity going right to the surface.
So if you do have a dynamic pipe, I can't just dimension again.
Basic
velocity. I don't know what a dynamic pipe is, so I'm guessing.
Well, the idea is that you have a region of sort of little vortex aloft where the air is being drawn in, and then the force is not strong enough to bring in any more because the Coriolis force is centrifugal force.
Inertially stabilizes the
and so the air can only come up below that, and when the air comes up below it, that air starts to move faster. It continues, and it just grows down. It
creeps down as it touches down the surface.
I don't think that's happening in this problem. Mm-hmm. It looks a little bit like it, it's true, but I think what's going on there is a little bit more subtle. But the important thing is that the initial spin up in all of the simulations and observations of the loft, okay? And the important thing about the fact that it's spinning aloft is not just that you have a source of potential source of rotation, that's important, but because you have confinement of a temperature anomaly, you can sustain a cold, saturated state long enough to get these downdraft-free eruptions of convection, all right? And it doesn't take much depression of the humidity aloft produce strong enough downdrafts to completely eliminate the possibility of an entropy increase in the down layer. So you really do, in my view, have to bring most of the troposphere, the lower troposphere, not to saturation probably, but pretty close before this can happen. And this involves a very subtle point. There's dynamics involved. You have to be rotationally combined. And the thermodynamics is terribly important. But the heart of this argument is that to shut off the downdrafts, you more or less have to homogenize, not perfectly, the moist static energy. If you're going to do that by an adiabatic process, you're going to wind up with a cold state. So that this cold mesoscale cyclone is sort of a necessary step. Let me finally add that during this whole process of spinning this up and trying to form the warm core, the system, I believe, is pretty horribly susceptible to disruption of our environment, a little bit of wind shear, wave activity and so on can disrupt this. So I would argue that hurricanes can only develop in pre-saturated environments, maybe not exactly saturated, but pretty close. normally convection itself can only bring about the state by homogenizing the static energy. That necessarily reduces the static energy of the boundary layer, and if we maintain convective neutrality, the temperature of the troposphere, at least down low, to be maintained, the cold anomaly has to be rotationally balanced. Low static energy pair also has the property of being more out of thermodynamic whack with the ocean. In the case of polar lows, metacanes and things like that that happen in higher latitudes, it perhaps is the only reason that the atmosphere is out of thermodynamic with the ocean. In the tropics, it's just an added thing. And that numerically, these embryos, I think you got the idea that the embryo is the saturated cold core low, is a really fantastic place to grow a hurricane. Put that in the model, it goes. And I think that's the standard route. How you get to that state may be very different in each case.